Thank you for listening, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. Talk from the heart, the mind, and the soul. And I'm your host, Andrew Fetter.
Well, welcome everyone. This is Andrew Fetter with When Pigs Fly. And I have an extraordinary guest coming on, somebody who I've had wanting for a long time and sort of fell into my lap, especially when I got his book. It is called The Ancient Alien Question. And of course, this is Andrew Fetter. With Philip Coppens. I'll probably pronounce that correctly. This book is pretty extraordinary. You probably have heard of him many times. I believe he's been on a lot of series, including the History Channel, about the subjects of ancient aliens. After reading his book, it actually tears up a couple of old theories real quickly in one quick paragraph I was just about to talk to him about, specifically with Sitchin's 12th planet idea, understandings, and the Anunnaki and all that. But I want to go into a lot of stuff, because while he's tearing down the myths of some things, he opens our eyes into other areas of our problems and issues which are dealing with the ancient alien question. So first of all, I want to welcome him coming on my show. How are you doing, Philip?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. I hope I pronounced your last name correctly. Is it Coppens?
It is indeed Coppens.
Okay, good. I always have a problem when it comes to that English thing, right?
Uh-huh.
I was really amazed, because some of the in your book, because as I was going through it, usually when you read about, because you bring in the very beginning of your book talking about, you know, different subjects, I know you go into contact, you really, like, hit a almost every subject I can think of, literally on the question of aliens in the past. And one particular one, which has always been my question, is the Anunnaki issue.
Mm-hmm.
And based upon the Anunnaki, the Sumerian issue, I didn't realize it was only Sitchin who came up with that idea at a lone base based upon his understanding of Sumerian language. Is that correct?
That is correct. I mean, an awful lot of material out there is actually traced back to a few things, and the entire Anunnaki conspiracy, reptilians kind of in control, you know, the Illuminati, all of that can really be traced back to Sitchin and one person who I didn't put too much emphasis on in the book because I didn't want to make matters too complex, but basically, Sitchin in the 1970s proposed that he could translate ancient Sumerian language and nobody else was able to do that, and that he had correctly identified the ancient Sumerian language, or specifically certain words from the ancient Sumerian language, and placed them in the right and proper context. And he believed that this proper context was the fact that these gods of the ancient Sumerians were deities who were extraterrestrial, and that they came down from Earth, from their planet called Nibiru, which he identified as a planet in our solar system which had a very elliptical orbit. It came near Earth, near the Sun, every 3,600 years, but then it also went far into outside of, you know, basically the furthest reaches of our solar system, and that at one moment in time, specifically 400,000 years ago, they had come to planet Earth to mine gold for things to do with the atmosphere of Nibiru, that they mined for gold for a little while on themselves, by themselves, but that at some point they began to adapt the local species of planet Earth. And he believed, Sitchin believed, that at that moment in time, mankind was created, and that after a while, basically the Anunnaki, the Niburians, whatever you want to call them, split and went back to their home planet, but that at some point they would return. Now, that was done over a series of books. The 12th planet was one. Sitchin added to this, he basically began with the Sumerians, but then expanded to include the Egyptians, the Mexicans, the, you know, the Maya civilization, to some extent the civilization of South America, each time coming up with the same conclusions. And then at the beginning of the 1990s, René-André Boulet wrote two books. One of them, I think, was Flying Serpents, Flying Dragons, or titled to that effect. And basically, he said that while reading Sitchin, he had identified certain specific pointers within Sitchin's descriptions of these creatures, and specifically, to some extent, even the likes of Moses and various other patriarchs and people in the Bible, showing that these were not just humans, but that these were reptilian or reptilianoid, and that some of the characters like Moses also had some of that reptilian skin. And so by the mid-90s, what you have is a person like David Icke, who starts proclaiming that there is a vast conspiracy. And what does he zoom on? He zooms on this idea that there are extraterrestrials in control of planet Earth, that these come from elsewhere. And, you know, he begins to really say that these are reptilians. He identifies a number of people, specifically Queen Elizabeth of England, as somehow being these reptilian creatures. Obviously, you know, the idea is also popular in science fiction, specifically V, and to some extent the Stargate movie and the Stargate series SG-1. But when you start digging into the story of Sitchin, you really, you know, I was, when I began with the ancient alien question, not just the book, but the entire topic, I really began to look at Sitchin. It was one of those books which naturally drifts to the forefront. If you do a search, you will find an awful lot of Sitchin. So I read Sitchin's works, you know, 4 or 5 of them were out at the time when I began. And over time, I became more and more critical and skeptical of Sitchin. One of the things has to do with his character. Sitchin never replied to criticism. Now, to some extent, you know, that is a personal thing. Nobody should respond to criticism if he or she doesn't feel inclined to do so. But there are some very basic points, and one basic point is something which has been pointed out by every one of his skeptics, and that is the following. Sitchin claims that he is able to translate material, that everybody else is unable to translate this. And this is, to some extent, a fallacy, because what is really is the case is that the ancient Sumerians had a lexicon. And so each word they defined, they described with what they meant. This is something which has survived the 4,000 or 5,000 years since this was written down. We have this at our disposal. Scholars have this at our disposal. And so when they said, "But Mr. Sitchin, you say that this word means this, but for the ancient Sumerians, it is clear that it didn't mean this. So on what do you base yourself when you draw this conclusion?" For 20 years, pretty much, actually longer, 30 years, Sitchin never replied to their criticism. And this is, you know, something which is of importance. It's not a scholar arguing with a different scholar about an interpretation, in which case, you know, it would be a battle of two equals, so to speak. What we have here is Sitchin being confronted with the fact that he claims to be translating something accurately, yet the ancient Sumerians themselves believe and define that this word means something else. And in no place where Sitchin says, you know, this is a spaceship, this is an extraterrestrial being, this is a planet, do the ancient Sumerians say this is the case.
So, excuse me, Philip, so isn't this where he, maybe the deck of cards sort of falls? He's like basically has a monopoly saying, "I know it, you don't, and I know the language." The whole cards are decks. You hear that, if you from a blanket standpoint, I know this conspiracy theory with Icke and everybody with the leather skin and all that stuff, which personally I think is malarkey, but it didn't seem like that. But I was always curious about the Anunnaki because I've heard that consistently. And that literally falls apart if, you know, he doesn't. It almost turns it into a Scientology thing of L. Ron Hubbard, tell you the truth. That based upon a science fiction, we've made ourselves a new found conspiracy, which we call, instead of religion, conspiracy.
Well, absolutely. It's you know, Sitchin does come over very much as a cultish guy. And when I say cultish, I literally mean not the sense that they're all going to commit suicide or they're all going to start killing other people, but very much that it is defined and confined. You have people out there who will try and, it's a belief system. It is people who are absolutely convinced. I've had people, I was booked on a few radio shows, and some of those people who were the hosts were so convinced about Sitchin that they basically canceled the radio interview because they were absolutely convinced that I was the demon, and everybody else who I was using in my book to substantiate what I was saying about Sitchin, they literally scoured the internet trying to find out about them.
They call you Illuminati then.
Yes. And my personal experience of Sitchin's work is definitely something. I was greatly upset just during the writing of this book with Sitchin because even though his big theory didn't hold water, I felt that there were certain things which he uses, elements which he uses, which should be followed up. And one of these things had to do with the glass in the Sinai Desert, which, in Sitchin's opinion, has to do with an atomic explosion. Now, irrelevant of who did this, whether it was Sumerians from Nibiru or something like that, the fact that there is glass beads in the Sinai Desert does suggest that there was an extraordinary amount of heat generated for this to have happened. So something had to have happened. And so I looked into that, and he was saying that there was a scientific paper published a few years ago, and that the scientific paper said that the scientists involved in leading the investigation had pursued every single avenue and had excluded every normal possibility as to how this glass could have formed, in which Sitchin said, so if we have excluded all the normal possibilities, the only ones which are left are the more extraordinary ones. And so, Sitchin filled this in as being evidence of some kind of nuclear warfare, some kind of nuclear explosion, which indeed would be a logical conclusion to make. But Sitchin had left enough indications, because Sitchin hardly ever footnotes. And to some extent, you need to footnote sufficiently. Some academics, I think, footnote too ridiculously. And some other people footnote themselves, which I always think is very funny. They footnote previous books, which they've written. In the case of Sitchin, in this case, he had left sufficient material for me to trace down this paper. And so, fortunately, the paper was actually available online for free. I downloaded it, and in the very introduction, it actually says that this person, this researcher, has looked into this glass material, and that he has identified where it comes from. It comes from a volcanic eruption, and the only thing which the researcher cannot do is specify which of three potential eruptions of a volcano it was done by. So the origins of these glass beads have been identified as being a volcanic eruption. Sitchin doesn't mention that, and it is clear that Sitchin has to have been aware of this, because from the way he's talking about it, it's clear that he's kind of not quoting necessarily, but almost quoting from the abstract of the scientific paper. So I really felt that in this instance, I personally, was abused by Sitchin. That this really was, close to being a con, because it is one thing to say I'm absolutely convinced that the ancient Sumerians are speaking about gods and 12 planets, and in a certain material has convinced me of this, even if he wasn't aware of the fact that there was a lexicon of the ancient Sumerian language. Okay, but in this case he has to have known, and that was to me a big disappointment in this man, which shattered all the faith I had left in him.
Astrophysicists would call that the collapse of the wave function. Because it's basically trying to produce out of his perception the result of what he wanted to perceive in the first place. So knowing that, but there's another thing, because that's pretty interesting, because I know that really sort of caught my eye when you did that and really quickly. The other one that also started me, because of the Dogon, the same scenario with with the Cyrus B factor with what's his name, Griol. Yeah, which you said how, and it was sort of funny because somebody I know told me about that, and I went and investigated looking at that myself, and that they suppose this, they're from Mali, West Africa. They're supposedly have some Egyptian connection, that they knew the like Osiris B and all the without they knew things about the cosmos without having a telescope or things like that. It was like, and one of the inferences was of Osiris B, knowing that there's the two dual stars. And then in your book, you show like the person who found that out was the person who sort of divulged the info to prove his point. So well, like, is that how can you confirm? How can we confirm that that's actually what happened? Because nobody was there.
Well, I mean, there's two things to that. One of them is that the Sirius thing is something which I have been looking into for a number of years. It started in the 1990s when I was working with two other researchers on a book. And then in my own book in 2002 or 2003, The Canopus Revelation, I basically went into that. And I felt, you know, over the years, more and more material came about. Now, the thing about the Dogon is very simple. The Dogon say that they have a tradition about a star which is barely visible with the naked eye. Now, barely visible with the naked eye means you can still see it with the naked eye, but it is hard to see, either because it is faint or, as I believe, but this has nothing to do with the issue, because basically it only goes very, it's very close to the horizon, so it sometimes is visible on a clear day, but on a cloudy day or when there are trees or, you know, mountains, you can't get to see it. Anyway, barely visible with the naked eye. And what this transformed that with Robert Temple in the 1970s in a book called The Sirius Mystery was that he said that the Dogon must have had extraterrestrial visitation and or telescopes. Because you know, Sirius B is basically a companion star to Sirius, and this was invisible to the naked eye, and as a result of this, you know, this proved that the Dogon had extraordinary amounts of information at their disposal, which they could not have had through normal means. Well, see what the Dogon say. The Dogon say barely visible with the naked eye. This becomes, oh, it's Sirius B, which is invisible to the naked eye. Hence, the Dogon must have had special knowledge. Neither do those two meet. Those two are completely different. If, you know, anybody says, like, oh, it's Sirius B, and Sirius B is invisible, the conclusion should be, by anybody, that this is not that specific star. Because, again, you know, the star which the Dogon are talking about is barely visible with the naked eye. So it's one, again, it's a theory which is based very much on thin air. And then again, as with the with the Anunnaki, you have various other people who have built layers upon layers upon layers upon layers about this Sirius aspect as to how our ancestors allegedly come from Sirius. And what I do in the book, and I think, you know, in the chapter specifically, is to say that at this moment in time, anybody who tells you that they have definitive answers as to why E.T. was here in the past, where they came from, or any of those other things, you know, they have not been true to the fundamental research. Were we alone in the past? No. There is clear archaeological and historical, mythological, folkloric evidence which shows, first of all, that our ancestors were absolutely convinced that they had visitations to some extent, you know, in the past, to some extent, some of them are writing when it is happening. So our ancestors were absolutely convinced of the existence of non-human intelligences and them making contact with our ancestors. You know, so the only thing debatable there is whether it happened or not. But anybody today who pinpoints certain obscure tribes like the Dogon, with apologies to the Dogon, or certain specific traditions like the Sumerians, and says that they know the absolute truth about E.T.'s connection there, they are theories. They are, you know, they might be right, but they definitely are a stretch of the available evidence at this moment in time, because so much of this material, unfortunately, has been pushed off the table for centuries, if not millennia, and some of it will be forever lost. We might never know where our space brethren came from.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's all based really more on theory. Nothing. There's actually, I think there is, which I'll get into. There's more, I think, material evidence as opposed to hyperbole that actually has. So something was here before. But there's another thing that you brought up, and it's sort of funny because the reason why you brought the biblical thing up with Ezekiel, which is interesting, because I wrote a book back. It was actually a fiction, but it was based on a guy getting picked up a ship, and he is shown how the extraterrestrials are involved with the. Involved with the human species, and there's actually two factions and da da da, but and it brings up not just Ezekiel but Eliyahu, Elijah, but in my book I also showed how there was actually interference between like the ancient Israelites, how they had a communication device that was what with the ETs, and the pillar of light was actually a beam, you know, and all that stuff of. You know, how they were basically involved, but that was in a fiction form. But it was interesting how you said about Ezekiel and how he was connected with a lot of the aspects of, you know, seeing extraterrestrials. And then the other side of the, and this is like on the, in the you know, obviously in the Middle East. And then in the Hopi, by the way, in which I've had a good relationship, which I did a documentary of, where basically they're literally, they say their prophecies, their understandings is exactly like Ezekiel, which I sound pretty bizarre. And so, and they have the same systems, and they also believe in the extraterrestrial. They have this guy called the Bahana, who is a, like almost like sounds like an alien who's close, who came and left, and which I'll get into with the, you talked of, I think it was called the cargo thing. I forgot the exact name you used in expression.
Cargo
cults. And you see like that situation, but I found it really fascinating throughout the Bible. There's all these elements right in front of our face that you pointed out with Ezekiel and the forming of the thing, which we don't want to get into. But I think the most interesting evidence that you pointed out in your book that sort of caught my eye, which no, I never even heard about, was the, what's it called, the Rubstub metal object found in 1976 that was made out of some unusual compounds. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, basically out of Russia, a number of objects came, and that one was one of them. I looked into pretty much five of them, and to some extent it is hard to kind of, out of Russia certain things came. Some of these things are interesting, but some of them are really hard to define as well, in the sense that some of these objects were found and then disappeared. Nobody knows where they went to, and so it's hard to substantiate it. When we're looking at a book like Mind the Ancient Alien Question, it's not an encyclopedic work, and it is also a status thing of like, where are we today? And so some of this was basically, you know, I could not maintain that this was good evidence, but that one definitely was, because the way it was analyzed, first of all, the way these various chemicals which are involved with it, the various molecules and molecular components are, shows that it could not have been created on planet Earth, so the origins have to be from elsewhere. And then it is also clear that from the way it is, it's not really accidental, in the sense that it's not part of a meteor or which kind of like, you know, somehow got smashed together, that there is some kind of design to this, that there is really more to it than that.
What does this object look like? Because it's just this metal object. So can you describe what it looked like? Because that's the only thing I didn't find in the book. I didn't understand that. What did it look like, even?
It basically looks very much like, how should I put this? Like a normal little object, like a rectangular cube-like. So it's nothing too posh, but also in the sense that it's also nothing too, how should I put it, accidental. Like, you know, it's not like a piece of rock mass or anything like that. So unfortunately, I've never been able to come up with photographs, but the work on most of the Russian aspects has been done over the last 20-25 years by a very good detailed researcher called Vladimir Rubtsov, and he has basically been able to show that there are things in Russia which definitely should be looked into as well. But again, some of these objects were, some of them could have been from lost civilizations, but this specific one clearly showed that there was, I should have put this, that this really could not have formed. These chemicals do not go together in this configuration on planet Earth. They, for that, they have to have had a different atmospheric condition than the one raining on planet Earth.
Wow. That's the one that points to me. That sort of caught my eye and everything. And they still have this available or this research or whatever. It's not like disappeared like I heard, which I'll get into, the Dropa disk that suddenly disappeared.
This is still in existence, yes.
Oh, the Dropa disks are in existence?
The Dropa disks as such, no, but the Russian artifact, yes.
Yes, okay. Let me ask you this, is the other thing I wanted to ask you was, I know about this, is the famous gear, the Russian gear thing. What is it called? I mean, not the Russian, I hope I pronounce this right. It's the Egyptian, I mean, not Egyptian, the Greek Antithera device. I remember seeing that. They thought it looked like it had like gears, and they thought it was like a clock, and then they said it was like an ancient computer. How would this doesn't really prove that it's extraterrestrial or anything or that nature, but that it shows that maybe our civilizations in the past had such abundance of technology that we're not aware of. Almost like I remember seeing in, I think it was in Egypt, below one of the tombs, they had these, they had thought that they had that there's like you couldn't even use a flame or anything, but because there's not enough oxygen to carry torches. But they had references where they actually had they had light bulbs that had the ability to use light bulbs, and there's drawings that people thought were supposed to be like, I guess, like lilies or flowers are really actually light bulbs that they used. Ancient Egyptians of light, so they work down or get inside these tombs that had literally no oxygen because you couldn't even light a match in there. So is that what this was pointing to, just the ancient the ability, the civilizations, or is it just a question of whether this intelligence came from someplace else?
Yeah, I mean, the existence of ancient technology in the past doesn't automatically conclude that ET was there. It really needs to be a kind of technology which supersedes the possibilities. And in the case of the Antikythera device, what we have there is a Greek device which shows that our Greek ancestors were more technically aware, that they were able to build elaborate metal devices with hooks and mechanisms, and that these mechanisms showed how the planets had orbits and how they all, how Mars related to Venus, to planet Earth, the Moon to Earth, and all of these things, and that to the solar system. Basically, what the Antikythera device showed is that our ancestors in Greek times were far more sophisticated than we give them credit for. But there is nothing there to suggest that ET was at hand here. None of this information is specifically hard to realize, and the mechanism itself is just a gear mechanism, so gear and wheel mechanism. So it's not like it's running on free energy or nuclear fusion, so to speak. So really, for all the evidence in the book, it really needs to be that our ancestors are either so extraordinarily more advanced than we give them credit for, or that something truly is going on. To a large extent, the material is which we're doing at this moment in time is really of the latter category, because when we're talking about a nuclear warfare, there is nothing today in history which even hints at the fact that our ancestors might have had some exposure to nuclear warfare material. So even in the lost civilization question, so to speak, when you are confronted with the myths of Mu or Atlantis or things like that, there is nothing there which takes it to a level that you would expect that to be the case. Some people have made those lost civilizations into that, but the material about lost civilizations themselves, you know, the Greek and Egyptian source information about Atlantis doesn't say anything about nuclear warfare. So all of those things really, really push it into a extraterrestrial dimension. And that is really why some of that material is included there. But a mechanism like the Antikythera device clearly isn't. I think one of the other things which we have to push through, and this is a separate issue from my book, is that we have to come to the realization that our ancestors are more aware and more technologically advanced than we give them credit for. And this is something which I think, you know, I highlight in the book. Eric von Däniken in 1968 posed 237 question marks about things, about history. And basically his basic tenet was this: history, the way we knew it in 1968, was wrong on a number of occasions. And on a number of occasions, it was so wrong that actually it beggared belief, that really, you know, we had to almost go back to the drawing board. And in a number of occasions, nobody had done any research. And in a number of occasions, he felt that his observations were so far apart from our ancestors that even, you know, a giant leap in historical understanding would basically show that this was not within the bailiwick of our ancestors, that this was really too far advanced. And so, you know, certain things have changed since 1968. Some of the areas are like the Nazca lines in 1968 were not explored. Eric underlined that these lines were meant to be seen from above, right, that it was, you know, meant to be seen from high altitude. Well, guess what? 40 years later, people ridicule von Däniken and say, oh, you see, von Däniken was wrong. These lines were not land airports for the gods. Well, that is not what Eric said. Eric said that from above it looked like an airport. And, you know, basically he said that it was meant to be seen from above. Well, science today is actually saying that indeed they have identified that these people had hot air balloons and gliders with which they took to the skies. And so they agree that these Nazca lines are meant to be seen from above. And now when it comes to, like, you know, an airport, like is such an important word. You know, and I always say, imagine describing to somebody things like the atomic explosion of Nagasaki, Hiroshima, or any of the tests done before or after. It is like, you know, when we describe it, it is like a giant mushroom. 500 years from now, I hope nobody is going to accept or believe or propagate that us in the 20th century believed that there was such a thing as giant mushrooms which exploded. You know, again, the operative word is like, and we should realize that we use that word like because of it. So, you know, it's a very complex landscape, and so where we were 45 years ago is that history was wrong, history still is wrong, but basically we are 45 years later, and despite what skeptics are pretending, you know, we have come across evidence which science cannot explain away, even 45 years later, and it still beggars belief. And that is precisely the evidence which I go about in my book, and some of that evidence, you know, goes into the chapter of the best evidence, because it really is the best evidence that we were not alone, and the fact that, you know, the people contacting us were non-human intelligences, and they just contacted us in a very special way as well.
Yeah, the other thing you had brought up, and I want to ask you about to get into, because I see most of the stuff that's found, by the way, and I want to talk about the gold flyers too, but everything seems to be of Western civilizations, even just completely West. I don't hear as much talk about, like, even though I've seen folklore and things of, like, specifically in China and India. I know you mentioned stuff in India, but what about in China or Thailand or Japan or any of those, the Eastern societies, civilizations in its relationship to the understandings that there's evidence of possibly of ancient aliens or extraterrestrial influence or whatever.
When it comes to some of these countries like Indonesia, near the Philippines, and those places, they had interesting civilizations, but none of it is really of a level to say, oh, there is an extraterrestrial component there. Even China, with all of its pyramids and all of its magic, doesn't really have this notion of this clearly an extraterrestrial component. Oh, there are monuments there which are of such extraordinary nature. The thing about China, which you do mention, is obviously the Drapa. The Drapa were a tribe near Tibet, where there was a tradition that thousands of years ago a spacecraft crashed. Which obviously is of a different nature. You know, some of these civilizations clearly had contact with non-human intelligences, and these civilizations were here to guide mankind along our road of development. And it is a case in point that this does evolve or revolve around, four big points: Egypt, Western Europe, South America, and Central America. And that is just, one of these things. Other parts of Africa, other parts of Europe, other parts of Australia or Asia do not feature as heavy in this equation. But it does feature into the equation of where what I would call anomalous space crashes happened. And so one of these things apparently happened in China, in Bayan Karaula. It is said two things. One of them is an archaeological trend, which was discovered in the 1960s, which basically said that there were bodies found and that the inscriptions which accompanied these bodies were relating a story about how these bodies were linked to the descendants of a mixture of the crashed alien beings intermarrying the local people of that region. And then more at that moment in time, but also more recently, there was a census in 1997 in China which highlighted that this tribe still existed, and it caused a commotion because they really looked different. In the book, there is a photograph from the 1940s which clearly shows that they have a weird skull, deep-set eyes, thick bone skulls. They look non-human. And so at the time of the census in 1997, it reached the attention of certain scientists in China who, some of them, tried to explain it and say, oh, this is probably the result of lead poisoning, to which other Chinese scientists said, well, lead poisoning kills. It doesn't cause genetic mutations. And that seems to be the status where it stands today. So you're right in the sense that only certain parts of the world seem to have been affected by this. But even when it comes to places like Peru, I always tend to point out that even though Peru has been, I would say, singled out for contact with a non-human intelligences who civilized some of the people there, it is very specific. Parts of Peru where, you have the Amazon, or parts of Peru where the pyramids are near Corral, do not show signs of what I would call non-human contact. It's only in the Sacred Valley, Ollantaytambo, Cusco, Tiahuanaco and the Bolivian Altiplano, where you see this kind of clear archaeological evidence, legacy of the non-human intelligence. And it's specifically there that the ancient accounts say the deities were present as well. So I think what we're looking at is the fact that very few places on planet Earth have consistently been pointed by ET to be contacted over and over again. And in the book, even though I don't make it explicit, but if people buy the book and they read it once and then they start reading it again after the second lecture, I think it'll become clear to them that there are a handful of places which are conforming to the same template, whether you find them in Egypt, whether you find them in Central America, whether you find them in Arizona, and that wherever this template crops up, you also find that contact with these non-human intelligences runs through the meat and bone of these cultures.
So it's like consistent. But see, the reason I was asking that in Chinese, understandings and stuff, if you go way back then with they have the flying dragons and, that a lot of their myths are really pointing out to like almost little like they've had ET influence. Lao Tzu just walked away and nobody knew where he went. And some people say, what was he really? Was he really like an ET or something? You know, there's a lot of references, like in Chinese understandings, that it just seems like it corresponds to that same understanding. So I was just curious why it seems always in the Western, a lot of Western civilizations, a lot of things are myopic in Western societies, just from what I see compared to Eastern. Everybody's focused, like, it's like everything starts in Greece, but then really, the Greeks were trying to figure out how to milk goats. The Chinese were, like, you know, thousands of years ahead of us. So, and especially in technology and everything. So it was like, I don't understand how, to me, it seemed even more logical that the Chinese were, actually, there might be more things over there that we don't know. Maybe it's just because in China it is now, you know, controlled or whatever. But it would seem more logical that they would have just as much or even more things, extraterrestrial connections. Because we always focus always Egypt, and they always focus now on the Mayans and all that stuff. It doesn't seem like, it seems sort of illogical that would just be those two places and not over there. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. There is, that's indeed, China is to a large extent still a land which is off limits. I was one of the first people who was trying to break Hartwig Hausdorff's confirmation that indeed there was such a thing as Chinese pyramids. And anyway, this is like 1993, 1994, when people still thought that there were no such thing as Chinese pyramids, that everybody, you know, had just dreamt this up somewhere in the 1940s. That's less than 20 years ago. I have spoken to some of the archaeologists involved in the pyramid research there, and they will tell you that, first of all, they have very weird ways of exploring these things. To them, archaeological research really is hiring a bulldozer and cutting a pyramid in half, and then seeing how kind of like, you know, the layer exists. So it's not what I would call non-destructive archaeology. They will also point out that they haven't opened most of these pyramids and that they have no plans of doing so. So they have a different approach to these things, and they are, to all extents and purposes, still a communist, i.e. atheist country. So anything to do with religion, I mean, books about Jesus are still by law forbidden in China. To some extent, for them, the ET component has a very belief system component to it as well. So some of these things are still taboo and off subject in China. So is there a possibility that there is far more to be learned from China? Absolutely. There is so much more to learn from the Chinese, as you're saying, just from their, what I would say, known civilization. I think there is so much more depth there. And I think also on the potential non-human components to their civilization, there is an awful lot to learn. But at this moment in time, there are no cards on the table with which to play. Even the story of the dropper has reached a stage whereby really now the next step is to go to this tribe in a remote part of China, for which anybody would have to have travel permits. Even if you were to get them, then you need to declare why you're going there, and you can either lie about it, or you can say, oh, I'm going to get DNA samples. The next question would then be, okay, why do you need DNA samples of these people? You then lie, or you tell the truth, and if you tell the truth, say, well, because we suspect them to be, partly ET, at which moment in time I'm pretty sure to tell you that the Chinese authorities will stamp your permit with a big letter no. There's still an awful long way to go, and it's not just China's fault. That kind of attitude of saying by default no to questions whereby science could engage themselves and trying to answer whether or not we have been alone is pretty much like, you know, not the sole bailiwick of the Chinese government. It's pretty much the standard bailiwick of across the world. And I mean, to add one aspect to that, I touch upon the Mahabharata and India, and India definitely is one of those civilizations as well where there is quite substantial evidence to say that something interesting might have been going on there. But some of the interesting aspects of the Indus Valley civilization are located in Pakistan, which at this moment in time isn't a top priority to some of to some people from the archaeological establishment either. It's very hard to get there. One of the most interesting things is that in southern Libya, 8,000 BC, people were mining uranium. This is a known archaeological fact. But for the last 10 to 15 years, nobody has gone to that area of the world, specifically not because after, I think it was 2003, January of that year, tourists were abducted. They were kidnapped by rebels who basically held them hostage. And in this instance, there were German and Dutch tourists who literally, at that moment in time, Gaddafi allowed the Dutch and German military to pretty much invade his country so that they could go after these rebels and liberate, I think it was about 50 or 58 tourists from the Netherlands and Germany who were held captive by these people. Archaeologists hadn't gone there long before, not just because of that reason, but also to do with the fact that the Libyan government wasn't willing to kind of like help them out there. So there are an awful lot of places which could do with such extraordinary excavation, but to some extent the political climate doesn't really say, hey, yeah, let's do it. And so you will get a slightly westernized, I think, perspective, yeah, of this world map as to where ET is possible or not. But my book really didn't set out to kind of like say, where is ET, where did they land. My quest is really a quest across the world, wherever I can find it, for the best evidence to say that we were not alone. And some of it you find in things like India, and most of it you find not necessarily in Western worlds. I mean, I think actually America, South, Middle, yeah, and North America is the most fertile ground to find these things. And it actually has very little to do with political climate or anything like that. It is largely to do with the fact that America, remained pristine pretty much until 1500 AD, and that everything else has been a layer which has been built over the last 500 years, whereas as you look towards things like Egypt, you it's been overrun on numerous occasions since the year zero, if not 300 BC with the Greeks. So the more clean a surface is, the more some of these things have been able to survive untouched, the easier it is to really lay your hands and say, okay, this is where the best evidence really sits.
Can I ask you, you mentioned also in your book about Machu Picchu, but you did mention, I believe it was in Daniken's last book, where he talks not just of that, but there is Pincho Pico, pronounce it correctly, that has just, it's not even, well, it's not as broadcast, but it's on the border of Bolivia, I believe, that has these huge, huge slabs that have, like, literally showed up even on Ancient Aliens on History Channel, which to me is the most confirming evidence of anything, almost like the device you said, that looked like it had to have been laser cut even beyond, and has these grooves. You know what I'm talking about? Is that, no, that's not Machu Picchu, that's
Pumapunku.
That's it. It's another, whatever. Yeah. How come you didn't elaborate that on your book? I was sort of surprised.
Well, it is in my book. There are photographs of it in my book, so I do touch upon it.
Oh, I apologize, because I saw Machu Picchu, which is another area, but I didn't see that one. I'm sorry. That sort of surprised me. Now, another thing I wanted to ask you, just only because it's my own personal, you mentioned the Wali Mesa in Hope, amongst the Hopi. Which mesa is that, on the second, third mesa?
I do the Hopi mesas as all three, so I don't make the... Oh, sorry, did you say Walpi?
Yeah, on the Wali Mesa of amongst the Hopi, which you said Wali Mesa is an area that you mentioned. So I was curious what mesa that is, because I know the mesas over there pretty well. So I was trying to figure out where you were talking about, because there's three mesas there. So where's the Wali Mesa?
Well, if it says Wali, then there must have been a P missing, I think. But it's referring to the second one.
Also, that's on the second mesa.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Because I was just curious. So anybody, you know, that's why I was my curiosity. The other thing I wanted really quickly, and then I want to get into this the science and archaeologists versus ancient alien thing, which I know it's well. Let me just get into that. Might as well right now because that's why I think the biggest perplexing thing. In your situation, the way you look at, because the way I'm looking at science right now, and I see amongst archaeologists the same thing. In the ancient alien question is almost running into the same taboo that I also find that even now there's a confrontation even among scientists when they deal with energy, even with the green or true story about our global warming situation, about energy and stuff like that, and looking at the universe in an infinite concept instead of going to a finite mentality. And like the methodology they use in science is actually sort of contrary to the reality of our science. So, which I've had many, multiple astrophysicists and physicists on my show that confirm that. That's the one that just the methodologies in science is sort of basically screwed up. So my question is you, it seems like it runs in the same parallel of another problem is where scientists and archaeologists dealing with the ancient alien question and the taboo of it. And to me, it looks like the reason why scientists and archaeologists run away from it because of the taboo of being, oh my God, anything to do with ETs, UFOs, extraterrestrials, is like considered the crazy thing. Something wrong with you. You've got to be kidding me. Green men in fighting suits. That seems the real reason why it's never touched upon among scientists or archaeologists in its true form. Because if they did methodically do it the way you had demonstrated in your book, they would actually either propose more questions of the same things or actually find more answers of things if it's applied, because I'm sure many scientists have more deeper ways of other approaches to getting to these situations instead of walking around with their, you know, heads between their legs, not wanting to deal with and facing these questions. So my question is, why do you think you're in this confrontation with, because I feel it is a confrontation with the mainstream scientists and most of the archaeologists?
Well, pretty much because archaeology has identified themselves as being, you know, they say that this is a question which they have already answered several decades ago. Van Daniken has been proven to be a fraud in their opinion, and there is no such thing as ancient aliens. So this is a dogma. You know, they have never done any physical research into this. So this is their dogma. So it's very much going up against the church. You know, it's their dogmatic stance. They refuse to look into this because they know it doesn't exist. And this is very much a status thing of science as a whole. Science doesn't want to look into that. Science doesn't want to look into the things like Atlantis. Science doesn't want to look into things like the near-death experience. All of the big questions science at this moment in time is simply not interested in. They're simply not tackling. And I think that is a big problem. And I think, you know, I'm one of those people who definitely want to tell the world that, you know, the people of the world have a right to demand from science, most of it which is funded by government taxpayers' money, that they should be doing something about this, that they should be looking into doing stuff, you know, for mankind. There is each episode of Ancient Aliens is watched by, at the end of its life cycle, 100 million people. So that clearly shows that there is an interest amongst the general public in these sort of things. And right now, all of these people are you know, beginning to basically say science is stupid because science is not looking into these things. Yet we can see with our very own eyes that there might be something to this. And clearly there is a desire from an awful lot of people that science is looking to this. So you're absolutely right that it is a, you know, a clash. But it is something which non-scientific, either popular movement or, you know, something else will need to happen because science is a very dogmatic and very lazy. You know, science is just nitpicking. Science, when it comes to archaeology, they will tell you that they are perfectly fine, that everything which we know about history is already known, and that everything else which we will dig up is just going to be confirmation of things which we already know, just more detail as to what we already knew. And that's kind of like pretty much where the church was 800 years ago when they said that everything they had to know about history and God had already been done, and that everything else was a continuous, glorious, I think, you know, whatever it was, beautiful word they used, illumination of, or whatever word they used, of God's divine presence. And again, science has become religious.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like if you're a heretic, if you're a scientist that step out of the box, if you're I think you mentioned in one of your books, I think with the bishop who got crucified, who got burnt at the stake, I forget his name. And then there's, you know, it's like being a Galileo. You would be the heretic if you are a scientist and you actually step out of the box, because it seems like they're building, scientists have been building their box for decades. Here, I'll give you an example that says it goes in the norm of our sciences, and I think it has to do with a lot of our cultural. Basically, it's like in like medicine today, we utilize methodologies to determine our illness by using energy, because we're basically all energy. You know, whether it's CAT scans, MRIs, you know, X-rays, whatever, even using sound. But yet, that's to determine our illness. Yet, that's real. That's really what we are: quantum physics, string physics. Yet they'll go back to Newtonian physics and to implement a after getting the diagnosis through energy, which is reality, to employ as if we're like a car, a machine part, like Newtonian physics, and give us a drug or replace a part, as opposed to, which is contrary to their findings. So in the same sense, I find that in science they're doing, it does the same thing. And this is in two aspects of looking at things in the realm of infinity versus finite. But they also do in the realm of, in this situation, building up the wall, because I think it's more has to do of being, you know, you're in a club, and if you're the guy who steps out of the club, then you're considered a crazy nut. And that's what I think it is. It's like Einstein taking a chance. I mean, Einstein was called a crazy guy when he came up with his relativity theory. They thought he was nuts, and when he said how how space was curved, and took years, how many years it took to he finally got confirmation that space is actually curved. I remember that thing that happened in Australia, I believe, with the stars. I forget how he did it. And then confirmed his theory on overall relativity, that space is really curved. So it seems like it's a product of scientists and of stepping out of the norm. And archaeology seems it just follows the banner of being limited in its aspects. It wants to be limited because they try to compartmentalize everything, and compartmentalizing it makes it easier for them to understand. Instead, again, stepping outside of the box and seeing things how they are. They basically, like, what's his name? You know, the Stitch, and the guy who made that misinformation, and look how it continued on and on as believing it's fact, and look at all these theories based upon bullshit. And then the same thing happens in archaeology. It continues on and on and on. And then it's, you know, it's like they've made an interpretation based upon what? And this goes back to, which I want to go close on, is I remember on Van Daniken's book, and this gets into the Mayan calendar of 2012, and where in his book he outlays what his interpretation of the Mayan calendar was, that basically it says, oh, they left and now they come back. That's all it is. It's 2012. And who's they? And it was, from his latest book, it was referring to how basically that the language, that the interpretation of Mayan was back before they had airplanes, and that's why they didn't have the understanding of what they know today. So a simple bad translation can cause problems. I know this just from people who, because I know Hebrew and I understand some Arabic, but how people misconstrue with translations from Hebrew into Greek and then into English, words can be changed consistently and made the wrong translation. And then even now that translation, it depends on how it was used. So that's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
So what, in your aspect, would you think would actually cause this, a change to people? So scientists and archaeologists would wake up and move forward instead of being walking ground within this little box of ours.
I think it needs to be something which comes from outside of the realm of science. I think it needs to be an event, pretty much, you know, which they cannot escape from, in the sense that they are confronted with something and they cannot push it aside. They cannot say, "Oh, we will not study this. This is not something which we should be doing." And I think once they are being told, either through circumstances such as this, or you know, basically those people who pull their monetary strings, that they have to start doing this, then they will always try and hide from these things. Definitely Western science. Definitely there's a more open-minded aspect, I think, in some of the Eastern Bloc scientists. But again, you know, I have been on scientific conferences where there are, so to speak, dozens of Eastern Bloc scientists. Whatever they conclude, however good they are, and quite often they are far better than Western scientists, for our Western media, for our Western civilization, for, you know, a top scientist, so to speak, from Russia or Czechoslovakia or Hungary to say anything, it doesn't matter in a Western point of view, because you will have naysayers here. There is something about Western science whereby they will always look for the naysayer. The media does it. You know, they will always find a skeptical point of view. Whatever, you know, somebody can do a lifetime of research on something and be called the father of his science, and the media and scientists as a whole will come up with some obscure guy who has been studying something for 5 minutes prior to airtime or newspaper quote, and they will label him as an expert in the field. And it is ridiculous, but it is, you know, to some extent what is still happening in the Western media. And one of the reasons why Ancient Aliens is so popular is because Ancient Aliens as a television show has stopped doing this format, because that old format of having an expert and then an idiot say no is so outdated that people are upset with it. You know, people don't want to listen to it anymore. They know that there will always be somebody out there who says, "Oh, I don't believe this." It's a given. But what they want to hear is the strength and the argumentation of whether it's Ancient Aliens or, you know, cancer or how to make, you know, popsicles with less ice and more milk or whatever, you know. They want to hear an argument in favor of something, and they have the own conviction to say whether or not something is true or not.
So, what and overview of what you tried to get within your book, what would you say what you're trying to, after reading your book, what would be your main objective?
My main objective basically is to offer to everybody who's read the book to say, here is, you know, a body of evidence which I think is reasonable, which makes it clear that the likely answer is that we were not alone. Definitely our ancestors believed that we were not alone. And so we are in a situation where we can agree with our ancestors or we can disagree with our ancestors. And also I think that it is a situation whereby we have reached a point whereby really, you know, it is not just cuckoo people who are asking the ancient alien question. It is a question which is slowly getting inroads in parts of science, but not the primary areas of science, in the sense that, you know, you have astrobiologists who are completely open to the fact that there is such a thing as ET out there, and that ET might have been here in the past. There are various other bits of scientists, but it is this cross-disciplinary approach in science which isn't working. It's very fragmented. An archaeologist only wants to listen to a fellow archaeologist. He doesn't want to hear anything to do with somebody else, even however good that person is or however much he might contribute to the cause. They don't want to listen listen to this. So basically, I want to tell people, you know, that there is that aspect which is basically stopping the world from realizing or accepting the world from realizing that indeed we were not alone in the past, and you know that there is solid argument out there, solid evidence out there to underline this argument that we were not alone.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Phil. This is like, I mean, I can go on and on, but our time has really gotten up. Because I actually had more. I went through a whole series of notes on my iPad here, trying to, in fact, yesterday, I spent literally 8-10 hours trying to figure out what to ask, because I know there's too much stuff. You go on and on. Everybody out there, I just really highly recommend this book. Anybody who even has inclination of curiosity of our past with ancient aliens in the past, and with especially with the real dogmas and things that have been introduced, questions about certain things, like even the Anunnaki, or you have questions about that and the theories, it points straight to them. It clears certain things up, but then opens up questions and other things. I really, really recommend. I really want to thank you for coming on my show, Philip. This has been really enlightening. How can they get in touch with you, or even find out more aspects, or do you have a website they can look at and get your book?
Yes, they can go to my website, which is philipcoppens.com, which is philipcoppens. If you type in my name into Facebook or Twitter, you will come to me as well. Or from my website, you can basically click on the Facebook and Twitter and come to me as well.
Well, again, Philip, thank you very much for coming on my show. And everyone, I wish everyone a great and glorious weekend. God bless you all. As we say, when pigs fly, and God bless you. Thank you again for listening in. Thank you. Bye.